This broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2005 lecture series presents The Uncanny, the Queer, and the Creepy, Fictions of Artificial Life by Ross Chambers, George A. Miller Endowment Visiting Professor, UIUC, and Professor of French, University of Michigan, on Tuesday, September 28th at 7:30 p.m. on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, with theatrical performances of Arlene Hutton's As It Is in Heaven and Shakespeare's King Lear by the U of I Department of Theater, and Sarah Kane's Psychosis 4.48 by the Royal Court Theater of London. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of cheeses, 25 kinds of olives, and 100 kinds of olive oil. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen today. During the first hour of the show, we'll talk about women's health issues with Suzanne Troopin. She's professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, also a practicing physician. And she'll join us to take your questions on women's health issues. I also want to mention that at 11 o'clock this morning, we'll talk with Hank Spies of the Spies Home Inspection Service about home maintenance and improvement. Something we do usually a week ago, would have been the third Monday of the month, but Hank will join us instead at 11 o'clock this morning because he couldn't be with us last week, so we thought we'd make up that absence this week. I also want to mention one other thing that's happening this week on the show. By a remarkable effort, I think, on the part of our producers, we have lined up all three of the candidates in the Illinois 103rd Illinois House of Representatives District, the 103rd House District, which includes Champaign-Urbana. We'll have all three of the candidates in that race. Deborah Frank Finan will be on the show tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Then we will speak with the incumbent, Naomi Jacobson, at 10 o'clock on Thursday, and at 10 o'clock on Friday, Tom Mackeman. He is the socialist equity candidate for the 103rd, Naomi Jacobson, the Democrat, and, of course, Deborah Frank Finan, the Republican. So all three candidates will be with us, and you'll have an opportunity to talk with them to help you make up your mind how you're going to vote for that race in November. And Suzanne Troopin joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Always good to see you.
Yes.
We didn't have a chance to talk before the show.
I know, but you always have things to ask me. I know you. Well, there's quite a bit new. There was information in the news about osteoporosis and exercise, and information in the news about weight loss and improving ovulation for women with polycystic ovarian condition. There was a study that got a lot of attention regarding long-term medication for people with chronic yeast infections, and a lot of women self-treat their own yeast infections at home. So that's always something they like to discuss with their doctors, because then they go off for the rest of the year to manage on their own. And there was a new study about bleeding after intercourse, and actually showing that it's a little bit more significant than even the gynecologist thought about. And there was some information about epidurals, and we have a lot of new osteoporosis studies going in our office, so I could talk about that a little bit, too.
Yeah. Well,
so we got all kinds of things to talk about.
A whole range of things. Well, I didn't give out the phone number, so let me do that real quick. If you'd like to join us, your questions are welcome for Suzanne Troopin. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And Suzanne Troopin, in addition to being a professor at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, practicing physician, and conducts a wide range of research, so she's up on a lot of things. So your questions, we'll do the best we can, put it that way, during this hour.
Absolutely. I always get good questions.
Right. Well, I mean, I've got a list of things that I wanted to ask you about, but we can, you know, we can kind of play it by ear. One of the things that I have had some people suggest to me that we talk a little bit about, you know, there's a wide range of nutritional supplements out there, and I know we've talked about this in the past, but I think they're increasingly popular. And one category of these are not exactly nutrition, but sort of anti-aging hormonal kind of supplements that people, I think, increasingly are interested in, a lot of people are using. You know, and they range from, you know, estrogen and testosterone to DHEA, HGH, melatonin, et cetera. And, you know, that's a wide, you know, it's an open-ended question, I guess. But, you know, for people who, you know, they read some of the glowing accounts of what these things do for people. And, you know, it'd be, I guess the question is, what does the medical research show in general? What can you say?
Well, I think in general, what I call Western physicians, basically the average physician in the United States, have been somewhat skeptical because we don't have access generally to these products. These products aren't controlled by the FDA. They vary quite a bit in their content, just even from not just from product to product, but individually within each product, you can get a lot of variation. A few years ago, this is quite a bit ago, the PDR came out with an over-the-counter kind of PDR. And then there's also a supplement that specifically talks about herbal medications. But these kinds of supplements do fall under food, essentially, and are not regulated under even any of those kinds of things. And one thing that we've been a little bit wary about are, how is what you're going to take in these supplements going to mix or replace what you're on, and how is that going to be monitored, and how can a physician really know what kinds of blood levels you're getting of these medications? So it's been very controversial. Melatonin was primarily used for sleep, and of the studies that have come out in traditional kinds of journals, it didn't really show, even though we know that physiologically melatonin rises and falls with our own so-called biological clock and the amount of light we're exposed to and so forth, we're not really sure how replacing it in a pill would actually change things. So that, for instance, we've had some interesting research that on shift workers, and shift workers, for instance, have an increased rate of breast cancer, and we think that it has something to do with their own melatonin levels, and if that, how will supplements end up affecting those kinds of risks that are just so far removed from anything we're actually studying? Mm-hmm. In terms of the estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone, which are fairly commonly prescribed to American menopausal women, you can get some fairly similar products. Most of my patients are trying to use transdermal, meaning over-the-skin creams of progesterone to replace other progesterones given, and they feel like they tolerate those creams very well, in part because many patients themselves tend to not be progesterone tolerant. So if you now take it in a cream and you're actually getting very little into your system, that's why you feel better, because you didn't really tolerate the medicine to begin with.
Yeah.
And we only use progesterone for counterbalancing the effects of estrogen on the lining of the uterus. And now that we've had the Women's Health Initiative study that seemed to find a big difference in breast cancer risk from women taking estrogen-progesterone combinations versus women taking estrogen alone, there's a new interest in trying to figure out ways to supplement menopausal women who need it with estrogen only, or estrogen and something besides the kinds of progesterone she's not been tolerant to. And trying to figure out exactly how much progesterone somebody might need, like particularly these perimenopausal or very early menopausal women, say women in their late 30s, early 40s, who now are skipping periods and perhaps just need progesterone therapy versus estrogen. And I think physicians are starting to be responsive of being able to prescribe that so that they wouldn't necessarily go over the counter. Human growth hormone's more problematic. There have been some case reports, particularly in animals, where high levels of human growth hormone, you know, it's a growth hormone. It can mm-hmm. unmask a cancer, that sort of thing. So it's more problematic and only being studied a little bit in older individuals, although there's just so much interest, because decreased energy and fatigue is a huge problem as we age at all. I know lot of my patients aren't aged with those complaints, but by any means, but as we get older, so anything in the way of those supplements that improves your muscle and your stamina and endurance is so appealing.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the traditional doctors have to meet up with the supplement doctors. I think that we would welcome more information on some of those supplements, but probably most physicians that you meet are a little wary of the fact that people can get so many of these things. DHEA, in all of its forms, can actually elevate blood pressure and increase your risk for cardiovascular disease and increase your problems with cholesterol. So it's the kind of thing that needs to be monitored. So I guess the bottom line is you got to walk into your physician's office with a list of what you're on and yeah. try to discuss it in context with what else they're giving you and try to find out if this is really something that you need, if there's something improved benefit. There's, in terms of living long, there's nothing that's going to beat proper nutrition, proper weight control, cutting down on the alcohol, cutting down the caffeine, and increasing the exercise. And if you do all that, maybe you don't even need any supplements, not even the doctor prescribed ones.
See, that's there were two things from what you said and that last point is, I think, the key. People are looking for a magic pill, and we certainly, we read about, hopeful of breakthroughs, genetic
right.
research is yielding clues, to human health and longevity.
Right.
And we hope that there's going to be some actual formula that we can take that's going to do that. But if we don't exercise and eat right.
Right. And you can't replace 50 years of bad behavior with even, a few months of a pill. And when we look at, for instance, Japanese cultures that are very high in soy intake and they're low rate of heart disease, but they had that soy intake from childhood on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that you can start in your 50s and approximate what they were doing before.
Yeah. We have a call to talk with. Let's include them. We'll go to our first caller, line number one in Urbana. Good morning.
Hi. I know you said that you were going to maybe address some osteoporosis issues, and I was wondering if you had any knowledge of studies linking Fosamax to the development of heart problems.
No. Are you quoting a specific study?
No, I was just curious. I was wondering.
Okay. Well, for listeners who may not know, the disease osteoporosis is specifically a condition where a individual's bones have an increased propensity to fracture, and it's primarily due to loss in bone strength due to a compromise of how much calcium is actually incorporated into the bone structure as we get older. And we have defined certain conditions as normal, meaning certain thicknesses of bones are normal. If your bone isn't quite that thick, but not very much less, we define that condition as osteopenia, which is a lower bone mass. And we define osteoporosis as somebody that is really more than 2.5 standard deviations from a normal young adult's bone mass. And their increased risk of fracturing is quite high, about 6 to 10 times the rate of their fracture rate in somebody with normal bone mass. And we have a variety of treatments and medicines out there that can that are approved for, one, the treatment of perfectly healthy people who have normal bone mass and are hoping over time to preserve that normal bone mass. There are treatments that are specifically approved for treating osteopenia, slightly low bone mass, and there are treatments approved for treating osteoporosis specifically. Fosamax is one of those medicines that's both indicated for the prevention of osteoporosis, for the treatment of osteopenia, and the treatment of osteoporosis. It's a drug called a bisphosphonate, and there are two bisphosphonates currently on the market. One's called alendronate, one's called ricindrenate, and Fosamax is the alendronate, and ricindrenate goes by the brand named Actonel. And bisphosphonates really only affect the bones, and they don't have any specific heart benefit, unlike some medicines like we didn't know, but we thought, and it's still somewhat controversial, hormone replacement therapy might have some heart benefits. But also there's a drug, Avista, that's also it's a chemical similarity to a hormone, but it's not a hormone therapy, and it's approved for prevention and treatment of osteoporosis as well. And there are other medicines worldwide. There are other bisphosphonates that are under testing. We're involved in testing a new one. There are other SERMs, which are cousins of the Avista, that are under testing. And so I have not been aware that Fosamax causes any heart problems. They've had up to a 10-year study with Fosamax, knowing that over the 10 years, it's number one, been safe, and number two, had continued benefit for prevention of hip fracture over time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. We have lines open right now. I think somebody was trying to call, but we couldn't answer the phone at the moment. If you would like to call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And our guest again, Suzanne Troopin. She's professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, also a practicing physician. And we're taking your questions on women's health issues. We have a couple callers who are about to be lined up, but I wanted to follow up on our initial conversation because there was one other question I had about the nutritional supplement question, and you said that it is important to discuss that with your physician. And I wondered if, let's say I walk into my doctor or my wife does, and, you know, we say, well, we're taking HGH and, you know, some other stuff that we bought over at GNC or whatever.
Sure.
Are you going to look at us and go, what are you, nuts? I mean, I think people feel a little bit, you know, a little bit worried
about. There has been a lot of that. And I think that that a more rational approach, even bringing a label in or that sort of thing, I think a more rational approach would also be start one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. And also, I think even before you start all that, you back up and you figure out, okay, what are you really trying to accomplish, and what medical evidence is there that with what you're taking, you're going to accomplish that end? And, you know, if I have patients and they say, hey, mom's 94 and dad, you know, lived to 89 and I had a grandma who lived to 100.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing? You're going to be there, too.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't need to, you know, even spend your money on that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I would say before you start taking hormones like that, you would want to know what your heart health is and be sure that it's safe. And then also come up with a monitoring plan. Okay, let's get you taking your blood pressure after you institute DHEA. You know, stop at Walgreens or wherever pharmacy. And I'm sorry.
Hey, that's a nice ring. I like that.
I didn't turn my phone off.
I like that ring. That's very
so,
cool.
So, yeah. But anyway,
yeah.
Sorry.
That's quite all right.
Everybody
that.
Does that, I'm sure. And at any rate, so,
yeah.
Of course, I can't remember what I was saying. But I do think that it is true that there are too many negative attitudes regarding it. And I think that that's a block to good health care.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, we have a couple callers. Let's go on and talk with them. Next up, an Indiana caller on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Two things, but they interrelate. I was wondering if you have any information about supplements in general, why they are not required to state certain things on their labels, particularly if ones interact with something else that could cause high blood pressure or something like that you mentioned earlier in the show. I have an aunt who's... unfortunately, just doesn't get enough money from the government, and she has, you know, she has pills that if she took them would be more cost more than what she actually gets on Social Security.
Mm.
So she's decided to start going to the herbal stores, and I tried as best I could to explain to her that you don't know anything about them, that the amounts can change within the same product right on the damn shelf, far as that goes, and that usually the although the folk wisdom has it that they did some good, they find out the reason why is because there's certain chemicals in there, but usually those things are concentrated when you get them in pills and things from a doctor. And I've checked into this because I wanted to hear what people say. And some of the people in stores, they should be taken out of those stores and put someplace else, because they have no medical knowledge, but everything is good, no problems, you know, everything like that. And I'm real concerned about my aunt. She's had a mild stroke in the last couple of weeks, and she's, as I said, she's not taking her medicines because she can't purchase them. And
that really upsets me,
and I just can't believe that the herbal boys have got that much pull in Congress like pharmaceutical companies do. I really don't understand it. Thanks a lot.
Your points are absolutely excellent and right on target. There's a lot of information on both the FDA site and exactly why some of these products are classified as foods rather than as pharmaceuticals. And it's been a point of big controversy for about 10 years. And actually, probably if people look into the cost effectiveness, they may think that these things are cost effective, but of course they're not. And of course, these supplements would never be covered under even plans such as Medicare, which virtually everybody over the age of 65 is on. Your aunt may not quite be that age yet, but it is a problem. There is a lot of information in the public sector regarding it, and I think we just have to keep the public pressure up, and I think eventually these substances will fall under the same guidelines as their counterparts in the medical world.
Not to sound like a booster of herbal medicine or anything, I don't know enough about it to make up my own mind about it. But I mean, isn't there some evidence that there is some health benefit from a lot of these things? We just don't have the research to show exactly what that is and how they interact.
Right, and there are more and more studies being done, and most of the medical journals out now are starting to publish studies on them. So the information is getting out there, but a lot of times these articles are a whole big article covering dozens and dozens of products that have lots of different indications, and it's been kind of tough for individual physicians to implement the use of those in their practice. Mm-hmm. And as we use more, we find out other things. For instance, even something simple like St. John's wort, which has been shown to have a lot of benefit for certain conditions, can interact with any of your anesthesia medicines, so that for elective surgery, we require people to be off of it for 2 weeks. But if you're going to have an emergency surgery, you were taking it last night. So that's the kind of thing that we haven't quite worked out yet.
Okay, very good. We have a couple of callers, and we'll go next to Marshall, Illinois, listener on line number 2. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my question is about Synthroid. I've taken it since I was 20, and I'm now 75. And what does it affect on the calcium absorption in your body? And also, I want to know the effectiveness of Fosamax. And I know that Synthroid might have something to do with the negation of the Fosamax.
Well, actually, Synthroid itself shouldn't negate Fosamax by any means. We know that individuals with thyroid disorders and very elevated thyroid can have decreased bone mass and
Mine wasn't elevated. It was, low.
Yes.
Low function, yeah.
Yes. And we know that if your thyroid is elevated, it can cause low bone mass. And same token, we have shown that if patients are over-medicated with medicines that are designed to replace a low thyroid, they can actually periodically get into a high enough range that their bone density is compromised. And the only real way to know if that's happening to you is to actually get a measurement.
I have done that.
Right. And so that is probably the main way that your physician's going to know what's going on with your bones. Secondary ways for your physician to figure that out would be to actually order an x-ray, because not all fractures show up on bone density testing. And the third way is bone markers, markers of bone turnover. And if you are in a very accelerated time of bone turnover, those markers go up. Now, not all physicians are aware of those markers, and that's another area that's coming to be, but probably not universal in all physicians' office. But if you have been properly monitored and properly stabilized on your Synthroid, you should be fine with respect to that particular medicine and what's going on with your bones. And you should probably be on 1,500 of calcium a day and 800 of vitamin D a day for yeah. most women your age. Now, in terms of the effectiveness of Fosamax, we think that we have about a 50 to 60% increase in the regions of interest, like the hip and the spine, when you use Fosamax over time, over many years. Now, that would be a percentage based on changes in the average patient, in the average study, looking specifically at those scores that you get from bone density testing. Now, the real benefit is in fracture prevention. In fact, we don't really care how thick a person's bones are. We care whether or not they have a fracture. But just so happens that the thicker your bones are, the least likely you are to get a fracture. And some of the protection of these medicines has nothing to do with scoring. In other words, in studies, even though your scores may drop, you still may do better and be protected more against fractures than if you had never been on the medicine. Mm-hmm. Number one, your scores may have dropped more if you weren't on the medicine. Number two, there are other physical things that happen to the bone. And one of the big controversies is, number one, how long is it truly safe to be on these medicines? As I said, we have 10-year data, but we're starting a lot of people in their 40s and early 50s. And so that's going to leave a little gap between 10 years and when they're done with their life. So that's being studied carefully. Number two, compliance is a problem with some of these medicines like Fosamax. It can cause some heartburn. And so we're looking at other types of medicines, other dosing kinds of things with similar medicines where you can take medicines. We're doing one study recruiting patients that have been on Fosamax and switching them to a medicine that you can take once a month, for instance. And there are going to be other easier to take regimens out there. But it's an extremely effective medicine, very well tolerated by many people. And bisphosphonates have been a very important strategy in combating hip, wrist, and spine fractures.
Okay, well, thank you for that information. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We're a little past our midpoint here. We're talking during this hour, Focus 580, about women's health issues with Dr. Suzanne Troopin, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. She's also a practicing physician here in the Champaign area and conducts a wide range of research, and your questions are welcome. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. A Champaign listener next on line number one. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I know this is a women's health topic show, but I was just curious if you had – I was going to make a positive comment anyway about some of what might be classified as herbal products, but these are what I would call pharmaceutical quality herbal – not necessarily even herbal, but for example, there was one company I didn't know if you were familiar with by the name of New Chapter, which is sold at health food stores and this sort of thing. And they have a high-quality line of products that, again, are pharmaceutical quality, do have research backed to show, for example, by Columbia University, that their products are incredibly effective, in many cases much more effective than, for example, a product put out by a pharmaceutical company that just puts one constituent element in the product, and they tend to put more of these subtle components that are also needed in their products. Now, anyway, I thought I'd ask about that and see if you'd heard of it.
You're not a sales rep, are you?
And I am absolutely not. I am, and that's why I guess probably why I call is because I think there's a lot of marketing in this country that markets towards the pharmaceuticals, and I'm just an average Joe who I used to have a chronic health problem, and I tried the pharmaceuticals, and I went to the traditional doctors, and they pushed the pharmaceuticals on me, and I found for me they never worked. But when I went to a more of an alternative approach, and I started looking at the highest quality companies in the herbal market. Now, and I'm talking about the highest quality companies like this company, New Chapter, just really made a huge difference. And I'll be the first to admit that there's bad herbal companies just like there are bad pharmaceuticals. I mean, it goes both ways. A good product is a good product is a good product. But anyway, I'm just curious if you'd look into some of those. And I just wanted to maybe make that comment for the listeners out there.
All right. Well, forgive me for asking, but I had to ask that question just because, All right.
Oh, no, I understand. Yeah, no problem there.
All right, thanks for the call.
Well, and I think there is a big difference between some of these nutritional supplements that are in powdered form where you have to mix or just sold as nutritional supplements versus some of the ones that are more packaged like a traditional pill and do have some research behind them. Mm-hmm. And I think that you can get more information about some products than other products. And I do think that some patients can certainly benefit. And yet you have to be careful when assessing a particular therapy based on one person's experience. We like to, in medicine, try to look at what we call levels of evidence. So in one system, it's an ABCD. Another system that most of us go by, it classifies level one evidence versus level two versus level three. And level three evidence is something like because an expert said or because a case series, in your case, the series is only a person of one. And we call that the worst kind of evidence, whereas level one kind of evidence is what we call randomized double-blind placebo control. And obviously, certain kinds of diseases cannot be studied with a placebo control. For instance, if somebody happens to be hemorrhaging, you can't just not give them medicine and see what happens and so forth. So there's certain studies that's just obvious are never going to be done. And so then we have to move to evidence called level two evidence, which are more rigorous prospective case studies and some things like that. So even in the pharmaceutical industry, there's some evidence that is better than other evidence. And my organization that I belong to, the American College of Obstetrician and Gynecologists, when they review their position on certain kinds of things, they grade. These recommendations are based on solid evidence. These other recommendations are based on mediocre evidence. And here out there in the literature, there's a lot of very poor evidence, and this is what it still says, but this is based on poor evidence. And then that helps you assess what's going on. And so just by saying that there's evidence, you got to dig even deeper than that.
Hope that gets the caller's question. We have open lines at this point. If you'd like to join us, we have just about maybe 20 minutes left or 15 minutes left with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology. I'm having trouble saying that word this morning for some reason here at the University
of
Illinois.
Just go with those OBGYN initials.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll try that next time. And your questions are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free elsewhere. 800-222-9455. It seems that every time I've been the host for this particular show, there is something new in the area of oral contraception, and I wondered if that's again the case. So what's the
Well, if you use the word oral contraceptives, by definition, that's something you have to swallow.
Okay.
And most of what's been new recently has been in the delivery systems of either patches or rings. And the Population Council is actually going to try a transdermal cream, a contraceptive cream. And I'm kind of excited about that. I'd like to know more about that myself. But they're starting trials in the cream version. And basically, with respect to these kinds of products, they're variations on a theme. Most of them have an estrogen and a progesterone combination. Some just have the progesterone combination. And most control pregnancy extremely well. And what we've done with these advances is increase the ease of using the product so that a ring, for instance, you just pop it in and wear it for 3 weeks and then take it out for a week when you have your period. And so you really only have to do one health behavior every 3 weeks to be covered. And with the patch, you change your patch weekly. And there are actually now some studies going on where women are wearing the patches more than just 3 weeks in a row, where you can wear them for more weeks so you have fewer periods. And probably having fewer periods is still the big news story of the past few years. And every day, I find patients who want to talk about that and be more educated.
Okay. A couple callers waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Bradley, Illinois, on line number 4. Good morning.
Hello. Both my husband and I have osteoporosis, and we're taking about 1,400 calcium and maybe 800 vitamin D, mostly in Citrocal. And just in the paper yesterday was an article about not taking too much calcium because of heart problems, that the magnesium, this calcium could disturb the magnesium level. And I wondered what you knew about that.
I didn't see that recent article, but there are many, many different factors in our food and our absorption. When a patient tells me they're taking 1,400 of calcium, the other thing I like to caution my patients about is how much are you really getting? A potato has 60 milligrams of calcium. A portion of broccoli could even have a couple of hundred. Certainly any dairy products have 200 or 300 per portion. So I try to encourage my patients to balance their intake versus what they have in their food. I also try to talk to patients about, well, are you really getting this? If you're chewing your little calcium tablet at the same time you're swigging a Diet Coke for the morning, well, those pops have a lot of phosphorus that binds your calcium. And so they're food and absorption, but we know that other vitamins, even vitamin K and vitamin E and magnesium too, are also important for overall bone health. And knowing exactly what's going to happen in terms of the balance of all those is important. I didn't see the actual article about the magnesium, so I can't tell you exactly how much is too much calcium. We used to tell patients, oh, don't get too much calcium because you can develop a kidney stone, but apparently that was one of those level 3 evidence kinds of things. And that's not true per se, but I'll find that article and see what I can make of it, and I can always bring back that information the next time I come.
Oh, okay, if you would. Okay. I had read, I don't know, 2,200 was safe or something like that, you know, for calcium, okay. We'll be listening for more information.
Very good. Thanks so
thank
much.
You.
Thank you. We'll go next to a listener in Peoria on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. Doctor, I was just curious if a woman makes a decision to go on hormone therapy, how do you choose whether to use a patch or a pill? What is the main difference, and how would you know which one is right for you?
Well, that's a great question. And there aren't just two choices. There are patches, there are pills. There's now a newly approved transdermal cream that doesn't have to be compounded that is available in pharmacies. There's also a couple of different formulations that can be used vaginally, but there is a specific vaginal ring that leaks systemic levels of the estrogen. There are also patches now that contain both estrogen and progesterone if you do have a uterus, whereas if you don't have a uterus, you only need the estrogen. So unfortunately, there are a lot of components to this decision. And we know that in general, when you swallow a pill, that you get what's called a first-pass liver effect. And when you take a patch or use a gel, and probably when you use the vaginal ring insert, you skip that first pass effect so that you don't quite have the strong influence on the liver from the transdermal that you do with oral. Now, a lot of my patients take that to mean that, number one, that the patches have been established to be a lot safer. That's not true. And I like to refer them to the menopause.org website of the North American Menopause Society, where basically they think there's not enough information out there in terms of exactly the liver effects and which groups really absolutely must be on one versus the other. And also, by changing the dose, for instance, a very low dose pill versus the highest dose patch, you may have about the same effect on the liver. So a lot has to do with dosing as well. And a lot has to do with symptom control. And finally, what your own patient convenience is. Some people just have very sensitive skin and the patch is problematic. Others have trouble remembering their pills. So just changing a patch once a week is more appealing to them. And a lot of my patients like to try both and see what fits into their lifestyle. But there are probably a lot of different kinds of components to that final decision. And knowing what you're taking it for, what you're trying to accomplish, how long you intend to be on the medicine, these may all be factors. And finally, the old realities of life, what's on your formulary and are your copays going to be a little bit more with one form of the medicine or another? And unfortunately, the copay issue has steered a lot of my patients away from patches back onto pills.
Just to clarify, so you really, I mean, the patch is not safer.
Well, there's a little,
there's
no real way that you can really put that label on a patch versus a pill. They both are very safe. They both have some risks. And the relative safety or risks may be slightly different depending on the dosing that you choose, but not enough to where any one organization has formally come out and said one type is safer than another.
Could you tell me the website you mentioned again, please?
It's just menopause.org.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Thanks so much for the call. We have about 10 minutes left with Dr. Suzanne Troopin, professor of OBGYN at the University of Illinois. Can I say that, professor of OBGYN?
Yes.
Oh, good. And also practicing physician. Your questions on women's health issues are welcome in the time remaining. The number, Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere. 800-222-9455. We had a question off the air about women and HIV, and I don't know exactly what the question was other than the caller wanted the doctor to speak about women and HIV. Is there anything particularly new or different with regard to women and
HIV treatment in general? I must admit I haven't looked at that literature for a number of months now. One of the concerns we've always had in menopausal patients is two issues. One is they don't get tested often enough. Mm-hmm. We see a young patient and we start thinking, oh, lots of partners get tested. And too many of older individuals that are at risk probably were never tested. So just getting tested is a good strategy if you have any risk factors in your past. The second issue is that if as greater numbers of women go through menopause without hormones or take themselves off hormones, the lining of the vagina is going to become more atrophic. And there were some studies that were done with other contraceptive methods and looking at lower estrogen levels and your risk of acquiring HIV. And we found that if you have vaginal atrophy, you're more likely to get minor cuts from intercourse. And actually, any of those cuts would actually increase your risk for acquiring HIV. So although this population isn't generally thought of as at risk, they actually still are.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Hope that helps. We have a couple callers. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on a cell phone. Good morning.
Hi. I have a friend with clinical depression who is not doing well on her medication, and I raised the question about has she talked to her doctor about the impact of perimenopause? She knows she's perimenopausal. She does not know, where she is in the phase. But I didn't know what research there is related to our hormonal changes and how that affects depression or the treatment of depression.
Well, there's a lot of research. Unfortunately, some of it's been contradictory. There have been some early studies that showed that there was increased rates of depression in women in perimenopause. And there have been a number of studies recently to show that the statistical rate of depression doesn't vary as much amongst decades as we had thought. Definitely, it's something for her to discuss with her healthcare provider and look into. And in And in an individual case, great strides can be made with the proper diagnosis.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Hope that helps. We have a caller on line number 4 next in Terre Haute. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I have a question about hyperparathyroidism. I have my calcium runs about 11 for the past year, and my parathyroid hormone is about 60. And the doctor is now talking about removing that parathyroid. Just wondered what you thought about that, and if you can tell me about the minimal invasive procedure.
Well, it's definitely an area that I would defer to a surgeon's judgment and probably an endocrinologist's judgment in terms of when and exactly to treat. And with some endocrine disorders, if the consequence of the endocrine disorder is only mild abnormalities in the thing that it controls, in the case of the parathyroid hormone, it's the calcium control, they may elect to follow that condition prior to therapy. You certainly don't want the treatment to be worse than the disease, and in some cases there are known side effects. And with the elevated parathyroid, it is one cause of osteoporosis. It is one cause of calcium abnormalities. And even though your calcium may be raised in your bloodstream, it may be leaching out of the bones faster than it's getting replaced into the bones. And therefore, that is why, even though the calcium's high, and it might lead us to think, oh, high blood calcium, we must have a lot of calcium in our bones, the actual net effect is the opposite. So getting a bone monitoring is definitely important. And possibly, as I said before, a consultation with an endocrinologist to decide that further management. And they would probably be able to guide you more on the types of surgical procedures that they're doing now.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We have 5 minutes left with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. If you'd like to get in real quick, we'll be able to include you. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. A couple other issues that I had noted. There was a couple articles. I'd kind of surfed the web, to see
sure.
What's new. Cholesterol levels in women, it seems that they mean different things than they do in men.
Oh, they do, and it's so hard to sort out exactly what that is. The general thinking has been that that cholesterol is a predictor of cardiovascular disease, and that the greater your cholesterol is, the greater your overall risk of having a myocardial infarction, i.e. a heart attack or a stroke. But it turns out that there are dozens of potential compounding factors, and that overinterpretation of that cholesterol number can be quite hazardous. We also have established these goals. We used to say get your cholesterol under 240, your total cholesterol. Then we said under 200. And it turns out that there is no magic cutoff, that those were statistically generated by looking at the population at the time they started to look. And for all of us, whether you're male or female, overall, the more you lower, the better off you are in general in terms of heart disease risk. Now, we know that components of that cholesterol mean different things, so that we talk about a good cholesterol and a low level of the bad cholesterol. So you want to get your good cholesterol higher and your bad cholesterol lower. Mm-hmm. But knowing exactly what those numbers means is confusing. For instance, some of my patients had very good profiles when they were on their hormone therapy, but now, based on the new evidence, they didn't feel there was reason to continue on their hormone therapy. They got off, and now their levels are not as good looking. And so how do we really interpret a patient like that when we thought we were looking at one set of numbers versus another? We also know that your levels of inflammatory products like your cardio C-reactive protein and your folate vitamin cascade, like your levels of homocysteine, are important. Knowing what your pre-existing atherosclerosis is, knowing where you are relative to menopause, it's all been very confusing. And every time you turn around, there's a new piece of information to put into the puzzle. So the puzzle seems to grow instead of the pieces interlocking. We just seem to wind up with a lot of pieces that don't fit yet.
But, you know, we still have this equation of HDL versus LDL, and you want to elevate your HDL level and keep the LDLs lower.
Ideally.
Okay, so there's a general guideline, at least.
And exercise does it.
All right.
So if you exercise, your HDL should go up. Okay. Unless you carry one of those genetic abnormalities, it's just not going to change it.
Let's talk to one last caller here, line number one, someone on the cell phone. Hello.
Hi there. I just wanted to pass along a quick comment on the herbals, since several people were calling in about that. That my physician told me when I asked him about it. He said the one thing that he added that hadn't occurred to me before was that the fact that in some countries they are regulated as drugs, and if one is going to be using an herbal supplement as a medication, it's better to obtain them from somewhere where they are regulated as drugs and standardized and tested and so on.
Well, that is somewhat true. Unfortunately, some of those kinds of things, a big one is the German Commission E, has put out publications and regulated some of these substances for a really long time. But then you run into problems. For instance, the black cohosh that's so popular for female patients to use in terms of their menopausal symptoms, German Commission E only recommends it for 6 months use. And I have lots of patients out there taking these American supplements that, and even ones where they have some of their product research along with them for a lot longer than 6 months. And so your doctor's caught a little bit in terms of, well, you know, how thorough is his or her knowledge of the regulations and the kinds of information these other countries and systems are giving you. And so there's no guarantee that their thinking is exactly along the lines of our thinking. And also it's not always easy to get a hold of those products.
Reflecting, you're saying that essentially it sounds like you're saying that the big component that's missing in this case and I guess in a lot of cases is adequate knowledge and education.
Right. But it's been improving, and it's improving steadily, and I think that the next generation of physicians is definitely going to know a lot more about these products than my generation ever did. My generation didn't even have nutrition in medical school. So we've come a long way.
Well, let's hope that we keep traveling that path to greater knowledge, and that's what this is all about. So we'll have to stop there. Our guest has been Dr. Suzanne Troopin, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. She's with us once a month, always on the fourth Monday of the month at 10 o'clock to take your questions. And thanks again so much, Dr. Troopin.
Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. Eastern Rug Gallery offers a collection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of all sizes, made of pure wool or silk pile.